Hugh McKay is Australia's most respected and experienced social researcher. The best-selling author of 19 books, including The Good Life, The Art of Belonging, and his latest, Australia Reimagined. Hugh believes something is wrong with our nation and in the lives of its citizens. And he's here in Bega today to explain what and why, but more importantly, what he thinks we need to change. Hugh has had a 60-year career in social research and was also a weekly newspaper columnist for over 25 years. He's currently the patron of the Asylum Seekers Centre and an honorary professor of social science at the University of Wollongong. He was appointed an officer of the Order of Australia in 2015. It gives me great delight to welcome Hugh McKay to Bega.
Thank you very much, Ian, and good afternoon, everyone. On a day like today and in a place like Bega, it's pretty easy to say what a fabulous country we live in. And then you remember that we are unable to keep a Prime Minister for a full term of government. In fact, I'm told paramedics can no longer use the question, who is the Prime Minister, as a test of cognitive function. We are about to become the world's most overweight nation. 2 million of us are either unemployed or underemployed. Our school education standards are actually falling. We have the highest rate of sexual assault in the world. And we're living with the greatest income inequality that we've ever had. But we're not here to berate ourselves. I guess everyone in the room is a patriot. We're all proud of the place. We all love the place. We're entitled to be proud, for example, of what we've done with multicultural Australia. We are, I think it's fair to say, world champions at creating a genuinely harmonious society out of such ethnic diversity as people coming from about 180 different birthplaces around the world. By the way, we sometimes congratulate ourselves as though that's something recent we did. In 1788, the first fleet arrived in Sydney Cove with 60 nationalities represented in the personnel of the first fleet. And of course, they arrived on a continent where 400 nations were coexisting. So multiculturalism, you could say, is in our DNA. So there are plenty of things for us to be proud of and a number of things for us to be ashamed of. But in the time I have with you, what I'd like to do is present what I think are the two most significant facts about contemporary Australia. And they're not good news. Fact number one, we are suffering from an epidemic of mental illness, specifically an epidemic of anxiety. Beyond Blue told us that last year alone, there were 2 million Australians suffering an anxiety disorder and another 2 million roughly suffering depression. So between 4 and 5 million Australians suffering mental illness associated with the anxiety depression spectrum. Beyond Blue tells us that 1 in 3 of us will experience some form of mental illness in our lifetime. That's fact number one. Fact number two, we are a more socially fragmented society than we've ever been in our history. That's a very big statement to make. Let me justify it. I think I could ask anyone in the room to stand up and explain how that happened or what is the evidence for a statement like that. But let me just quickly run through what I think are the 6 or 7 critical changes that have been happening in Australia that have made us more socially fragmented. Our households have been shrinking. They've been shrinking for 100 years, by the way. In the last 100 years, our population has increased fivefold, but the number of households has increased tenfold. So we've been living in smaller and smaller domestic herds over the last 100 years, but it's accelerated over the last 30. We now have a situation where one household in four, every fourth household, soon to be every third household, contains just one person. That's our fastest growing household type. Now, that doesn't mean that 1 in every 3 or 4 households contains a person who's suffering from loneliness, but it does mean that the risk of social isolation and loneliness is greatly increased in a society where every third or fourth dwelling, including apartments, contains just one person. There's one fragmenting factor. We've become one of the world's high divorce societies. Between 35 and 40% of contemporary marriages are ending in divorce. And that's, of course, not just fragmenting for the couple, it's fragmenting for their family, their extended family, their friendship circles, and the neighbourhoods and communities that they've moved in and out of. And, of course, every divorce or every relationship split takes a two-person household and turns it into two one-person households, at least for a while. And if kids are involved, of course, it becomes even more fragmenting. We now have 1 million dependent kids in Australia living with just one of their natural parents. And half of them, 500,000 kids, just imagine that large group, are involved in a mass migration once a week or once a fortnight from the home of the custodial parent to the home of the other parent for an access visit. Hugely disruptive for the families, for the kids, and for the micro communities that they're moving in and out of. And while we're talking about kids, I think I should mention another contributor to our social fragmentation is the falling birth rate. We're down to 1.7 babies per woman. Some of the people in this room are products of the baby boom after the end of World War II, when the birth rate hit 3.6 babies per woman. 1.7, less than half the boom rate. Why do I mention a falling birth rate in this context? Well, any of you who are parents know that if you move into a new neighbourhood, into a new town, it's usually the kids who get to know other kids first. They become a kind of social lubricant, and gradually the families get to know each other. So when the birth rate is at a record low level, way below replacement rate, our population would ultimately shrink if it were not for immigration, that social lubricant is in shorter supply. Now, we are compensating, of course, and I'm sure you're aware of how we're compensating. While the birth rate falls, the rate of pet ownership rises, particularly dog ownership. And we know that those animals are increasingly being used as child substitutes because of the names they're given. Have you noticed that that they're being given... no offence, Ian, but I recently met a dog called Ian. And I thought that was a really strange name for a dog. And then when you go to the dog park, of course, you can't remember whether Ian is the dog or the owner. Maybe it works for some people. But that contributes to our fragmentation. So does our increased mobility. On average, Australians are moving house once every 6 years. But if you've lived in the same house for 30 years, imagine how often some other people must be moving to get the national average up to once every 6 years. And of course, we're more mobile in the sense that we come and go almost everywhere by car, mostly one person in that little capsule, socially isolating. You see your neighbour's car arriving or leaving and you wave. You assume your neighbour is driving, but it's not the same as saying good day on the footpath, is it? What about the contribution made by our increased busyness? For all the promises of how we'd have more and more leisure, we are now working longer hours than ever, particularly people who are connected to their work via information technology, who say they're never really away from work. We've got to the stage where busyness has become a kind of virtue. Have you noticed that? We greet each other now. We say, how are you going? Busy? As though, are you dead or are you busy? Some of you are retired, I suspect. And if you are retired, I'm sure you very quickly learned that it's absolutely de rigueur for retired people to say, I'm so busy, I don't know how I ever found the time to go to work, as though this is a virtue. I'm looking forward to asking someone if they're busy and hearing them saying, no, there's not much on, really. I'm having a great... In fact, I heard a friend told me about her father, who recently retired, And people would say to him, you know, you're busy, what are you doing? And he'd say, I'm a human being, not a human doing. It's not a bad answer. But the other contribution, and in some ways it might be the greatest contribution to our social fragmentation, is the one that promises us more and more connection. And that's the information technology revolution that promises to make us more in touch with each other than ever. And of course it does at one level, but at the same time it makes it easier than ever for us to stay apart from each other. Now, I won't go on with all of this, but just think about even those items on the list. You could add other items to your list, I'm sure. Think about what the cumulative effect is likely to be of those sort of changes on a society. Pretty obviously, a primary effect is going to be that local neighbourhoods are going to be less stable, less cohesive than they used to be. And that will almost certainly mean, and we're starting to see the evidence of it most strongly in our major cities, that people's level of trust in their neighbours, in the people they share local communities, will be in decline. But a more fragmented society becomes a more individualistic and more competitive society, and that runs right against our true nature as human beings. Now, I said I was going to present two facts. The epidemic of mental illness in general and anxiety in particular, and our increased level of social fragmentation. But I'm sure many of you have recognised that what I'm talking about is just one fact. These are not two facts. The nature of the human species is such that if you make a society more fragmented, if you reduce people's sense of belonging and their sense of social cohesion, you will raise their level of anxiety. That's what happens to human beings. We are herd animals. Cut us off from the herd and our anxiety levels rise. Why do we use solitary confinement as the worst punishment we can think of in our criminal justice system? For precisely that reason. Solitary confinement is the worst punishment we can inflict on anyone. Not that it's not important to have time alone. We all need solitude. Why do we need solitude? Why do we need time alone? The answer is we need time alone to replenish our resources, to recharge the batteries for the very demanding job that we have because we belong to this species. And that's the job of interacting, developing, nurturing, fostering, engaging with the communities that all humans need to support them and sustain them. So if we've become more socially fragmented, then obviously we will have become more anxious, even though I accept there are many specific triggers for anxiety in individual cases. Some people say I'm anxious because my marriage is failing, or I'm suffering job insecurity or rent stress, loss of faith, addiction to IT devices, concern about the future of the planet. There's a long list of things we could become anxious about. But when you're talking about 2 million Australians in any year suffering from anxiety, in other words, when you're talking about an epidemic, we have to look beyond those specific triggers and say, what is the societal change that's caused this to happen, not just in Australia, but around the Western world in general? And that's where it seems to me the answer is social fragmentation. Now, it often seems as though the most interesting thing, in fact, perhaps it is the most interesting thing about you and me, is the differences between us. We get very caught up in the idea of differences, don't we? Parents who've got 2 or 3 or 4 kids saying, isn't it incredible that they're all in the same family and they could be so different? We're all so different. But actually, the most significant thing about us is not those differences at all. The most significant thing about us is our common humanity. The fact that we are, in our DNA, cooperators. We are communitarians. We need groups, herds, tribes. We need neighbourhoods and communities, not only to sustain us and nurture us and protect us, but even to give us our sense of identity. There's a lot of rubbish being talked about personal identity at the moment, as though you could discover who you are by going on a weekend workshop to find it. Don't waste your money on weekend workshops to find who you are. And you don't find yourself by looking in the mirror. You don't find yourself by gazing at your navel. You find yourself by looking into the faces of the people who love you, the people who need you, the people who'll put up with you. That's who you are. We're social beings, and you can only figure out who you are in the context of the people that you belong to. So if we're that kind of species, obviously anxiety is a symptom of this hazard of social fragmentation and of the problem that's growing in Australia and around the West of social isolation. In fact, psychologists and medical practitioners in various Western countries are now alerting us to what they believe to be a fact about this phenomenon, which is that social isolation is a greater threat to public health than obesity. Now, we know what a threat to public health obesity is. Now they're saying social isolation is a greater threat. And given what I've said, perhaps that isn't very surprising. Now, I hope you find all this interesting. As a researcher, I find it riveting. But it's not just interesting, is it? I mean, we are not bystanders at what I've been describing. We are participants in all the social changes. Many of us have been driving the social changes. Anyone who's been divorced doesn't want the divorce rate to get any lower in case they missed out and were stuck in a miserable marriage for the rest of their lives. We drive the birth rate down. We adopt our IT devices and become addicted to them and so on. It's not as if someone said, thou shalt be more socially fragmented, so get used to it. We've done it, which means, of course, that the epidemic that flows from it, the epidemic of anxiety and depression, is ours. It's our response. We've done this. This is what we've achieved in our society. And it seems to me we do need to start taking some ownership of it and talking, as Jeff said earlier, about some of the solutions that we might be able to come up with. Now, there's never just one explanation for some human phenomenon as large scale as what I've been describing, but it does seem to me there is one word that captures at least the starting point for the solution to this twin problem of greater fragmentation and higher anxiety, and that is the word compassion. Now, when I say compassion, I'm not talking about some kind of bleeding heart thing. I'm not talking about an emotional state. I'm not talking about something that's the province of do-gooders. When I'm talking about compassion, I'm talking about what I think is the only rational response that any of us could make to a full realization of what it means to be human. What it means to be human is that we are stuck with a species that is inherently social. We need each other. And therefore, it seems to me the only rational response to that realization is to say, therefore, we've got to treat each other always with kindness and respect. And that's all I think I mean by compassion. Treating every human encounter with kindness and respect, especially encounters with people we don't like much, and most especially encounters with people we disagree with about politics. So that's the test of whether we've understood what it means to be human. That's the test of whether we've got the idea of compassion. Will we act kindly? Will we act respectfully towards people, whoever they are, and whatever their views might be? Compassion has a twin effect. It's the great antidote to anxiety for the individual. Nothing steadies the emotions like the realization that someone else needs your support, needs your kindness, needs your response to them. But also, of course, compassion is like the high-octane fuel that powers the machinery of social cohesion. It's what runs any thriving neighbourhood, community, or town. And to conclude, let me talk about a town, an English town. Some of you will have been there, the township of Frome in Somerset, spelled F-R-O-M-E. By the way, if you want to look it up on the net, it's a fascinating story. It could be Bega's story. In the township of Froome several years ago, a GP realised that many of her particularly elderly patients who were suffering from high anxiety were also typically socially isolated. And she got together with some other medical practitioners, some members of the local council and other community leaders, and together they launched something with the rather clunky name of the Compassionate Froome Project. Doesn't sound very contemporary, does it? But anyway, the Compassionate Froome Project. Results of that project, it's been studied by various social scientists, results of that project are now starting to be reported. And the essential finding is across all health, most health indicators, there has been an improvement as a result of the Compassionate Froome Project. And the most dramatic and unexpected health indicator that's improved is emergency hospital admissions. Over the three-year period of this study, emergency hospital admissions in Froome went down by 17%, while across the county of Somerset, they went up by 29%. Okay, we'd like to do that in bigger, wouldn't we? So what did they do? What was this radical, creative, imaginative, open-minded, Compassionate Froome Project? It must have been brilliant, mustn't it? They must have come up with some secret that we never could have thought of. I'll tell you what it consisted of. It was an encouragement, a program of encouragement to people to get to know your neighbours. Always smile and say hello when you pass someone in the street, because that might be just the moment when they need the encouragement of someone to acknowledge that they exist. Get engaged, join a choir, join a community garden, join a church, join a book club, join a men's shed. Engage so that you become one of those people who knows what's going on in the community, which means you'll be aware of needs that exist in the community. Look out for the people in your street who might be a bit at risk of social isolation, who might be frail, elderly, unwell, etc., and make sure you stay in touch with those people. Give people the gift of listening when they need to tell you something, but never find yourself at a bus stop or in a lift or in a queue with fellow human beings without acknowledging them. Now, it wasn't very radical, was it? And I hope most of you do most of those things all the time. Bega, anywhere could do exactly what Froome did. And it does seem to me that it's at the local level where we will transform Australia and where we will be able to begin addressing the twin problem of social fragmentation and rising anxiety. The state of the nation starts in your street. The health of the nation can best be judged by the health of the local neighbourhoods and communities that we belong to and for which we are responsible. If enough of us started living as if our community was the kind of community we want to live in and the kind of nation we want to live in, then pretty soon that's the kind of community, that's the kind of nation it would become. Thank you.
Thank you, Hugh. A real thrill having you in Bega today. I know many of the people that are here to see you. Thank you for being here and sharing your wisdom and your time with us. We do have Hugh here for a bit longer before he hits the road back to Canberra. He's a busy man with people to care about, and he's been gracious enough to come to Bega today and take a few questions this afternoon. My gopher is Leanne Barnes, the General Manager of Bega Valley Shire Council. Who has a question for Hugh?
Or a comment. It doesn't have to be a question. If you want to brag about your street, we'd like to hear from you.
Hello. I come from Canberra, but I grew up in Melbourne in a community. And the thing that I've noticed in the last 30 years is this lack of engagement with our politicians. Like when I was a young girl, my father would be very active in the political sphere. And in fact, one of my childhood memories is at the polling booth, handing out cards, having a chat with the Liberal member, party members, while I was with my dad on the Labor Party side. But we were part of a community. But now, in Canberra, we have an MLA squabbling with someone from the other party about being blocked on Facebook. Mm. And I'm like, what's going on? Where I can't even get an appointment with my MLA. And they're all fixated with what's happening in the ether. So I just wondered what you thought about that.
Yeah, it's a huge subject. There's no doubt many people share your frustration about this. There is a feeling, and it's a modern feeling. You only have to go back two generations and it wasn't quite like this, but a feeling of the remoteness of politics from the life of local neighbourhoods and communities and towns and suburbs and so on. There are many factors contributing to this. One of the big ones is Parliament House. If you've ever been to Parliament House, you know why pollies think they're so terrific and why they tend to remain aloof from the rest of us, because they're hermetically sealed in an absolutely magnificent building with acres of marble, all of which tells them how terrific they are. And they're even isolated in that building from the media. So there is a curious, I think, psychological effect from that. There's also the effect of the fundamental change in the way politics is now being made. It's always been adversarial. It's become more bitterly adversarial because the philosophical differences between the major parties are not as great as they once were. Adversarial politics makes sense when you're really talking about conservatives and socialists, for example. But when everyone wants to occupy the centre, and when you could look at a list of policies and say, whose was that? And you'd often not be sure who was the author of that policy. The adversarial system makes less sense than it's ever made, but we go on with it, so it becomes this sort of terrible political infighting. And the other thing, I think, just very quickly, that's made the whole thing less community-based than it once was, is the sophistication of political campaigning and political propaganda. More and more we are treating politics like consumer mass marketing, as though it's brand Labor, brand Liberal, brand Turnbull, brand Dutton, etc. Now, if they talk like that, and they do, and if they think like that, and many of their strategists have come out of the marketing world, that trivialises the whole thing from our point of view, because it does. I mean, you know that if you prefer brand A but the supermarket is out of it, brand B will do. So if it's going to be like that with politics, that makes the whole thing seem more pointless to us. Now, the challenge in all this, and it is very easy to become despairing about it, the challenge in all this is to stay engaged. Not to put up with not being able to get in touch with your local member. We've got to insist that we say to our local member, I heard you in Parliament last week and I didn't like it. Or I saw your leader behaving outrageous. I wouldn't let my kids behave like that. You know, if they don't know that this is how we think, we have only ourselves to blame. There's no doubt that if the worst response to the current state of politics is to disengage from it.
One more question for Hugh. Anyone up the back? Good to see a question up the back. Thank you. Yes.
I heard or read recently through social media on one of the papers that someone who you probably know defined the greatest problem in Australia, the greatest cancer in our society, was the role of Murdoch media. And I think that perhaps, I was just wondering whether you think that the role of the media has been greatly influential in creating the kind of society and the problems that we see today, where the owner's personal agenda has become far more important than the social needs of the people.
Mm. Yes. I have a slightly unfashionable view about this, which is that I don't blame the media. I think the media reflect us. They don't lead us. I blame the social media much more than the mass media. I think as we rely more and more on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and so on, for many younger people, that's where they get their news. Talk about fake news, a lot of it. But the major mass media, whether it's Murdoch or Fairfax or whoever it is, generally speaking, the ABC is something of an exception to this, I think, but the commercial mass media, who are businesses in business to make a profit by attracting as many listeners, viewers, readers as they can, that's how they operate, to bring an audience to advertisers, they are reflecting, generally speaking, the mood of the community rather than creating it. And generally speaking, the mass media don't have a conversion function, they have a reinforcement function. So if you do watch Sky After Dark, you're probably there to cheer because that you're hearing what you think, or to boo because you're hearing stuff that enrages you and you want to be enraged nightly. The Alan Jones audience consists of a significant minority of listeners who can't stand what he says but need to have that experience. But even Alan Jones, who is often spoken about, Alan Jones has a tiny audience. Most Australians never hear Alan Jones. I think it's very easy to exaggerate the power of the mass media. Again, I'd say let's not let ourselves off the hook by saying it's all Murdoch or whatever it is. It's the state of our society is much more to do with how we are managing our local neighbourhood than any of that.
You talked about the need for social lubricant, and I like to think the Festival of Open Minds is a little bit of social lubricant, and that Hugh McKay has been the grease on the wheel today. Thank you, Hugh.